Chapter 18. Dr. Julia Huxley, the Oregon's medical officer, had flown out to the Wave Generation Station aboard the Robinson R-44, so by the time the nimble little chopper touched down on the freighter's deck, Sloane McIntyre was already hooked up to an IV that was flooding her veins with painkillers, antibiotics, and saline solution for her dehydration. Julia had stripped away her sodden clothes and wrapped her in a thermal blanket. She'd cleaned and dressed the gunshot wound as best she could with the kit she'd brought, but was eager to tend her properly. Two orderlies were waiting with a gurney when the retractable helipad was lowered into the hold and Sloane was whisked to sickbay, an infirmary that rivaled a metropolitan Level 1 trauma center. Hux's treatment of Juan had been a quick pronouncement that he was fine, a liter bottle of a vile-tasting sports drink, and a couple aspirin. At least Max was in the hangar with one of Cabrillo's spare legs. Juan dropped onto a workbench to unseat his mangled prosthetic. The Oregon had slowed her mad dash from Cape Town in order for George Adams to land the helicopter, and now, as he accepted the artificial limb from his second in command, he could feel the ship begin to accelerate again. He angrily yanked down his pants cuff and started walking quickly, calling over his shoulder, "Senior staff in the boardroom in 15 minutes." His team was assembled by the time he finished a quick shower and a shave that left his face raw from the straight razor he used. Maurice had prepared a coffee service and had a steaming cup at the head of the cherry conference table for him. The armored covers for the boardroom's windows were open, so the room was brightly lit, contrasting sharply with the dark look of the men and women seated around him. Juan took a sip of his coffee and bluntly said, "Okay, what the hell happened?" As Chief Intelligence Officer, Linda Ross took point. She hastily swallowed a mouthful of Danish. "Yesterday morning, members of the Kinshasa police raided a house outside the city, believing it was a drug distribution center. They made several arrests and found a cache of arms as well as a small amount of drugs. They also found a heap of documents linking the dealers to Samuel Makambo and his Congolese Army of Revolution." "The guy that bought our weapons," Mark Murphy reminded unnecessarily. He didn't look up from his work on the laptop Juan had taken from the wave-powered generator. Linda continued. "It turns out that Makambo was using the proceeds from the drug sales to further finance his activities, which isn't a big stretch. What caught the police off guard was how Makambo had managed to use bribery to infiltrate the upper echelons of the government. He had a ton of bureaucrats on his payroll, including Benjamin Isaka in the defense ministry. For 50,000 euros a year paid into a Swiss bank account, Isaka fed information to Makambo about the government's attempts to locate his secret base of operations. He continually tipped off the rebel leader, so Macambo's army was always one step ahead of government troops." Max was seated at the opposite end of the burnished table, his bulldog face more dour than normal. "Makambo knew from the moment we first made contact, pretending to be arms merchants, that he was being set up. Isaka told him about how the weapons had been fitted with radio direction tags. His first step after we made our escape was to dismantle the AKs and RPGs and toss the tags into the river."
"Isaka has admitted to this?"
"Not publicly," Max said, "but I've been on the phone with a couple of people in their government. Once I explained who I am and all, they told me the team sent to track the arms reported they never left the dock before they simply stopped transmitting."
"And when they reached the dock," Juan said, coming to the same conclusion as the others, "there was no sign of the rebels or the guns."
He looked at Mark Murphy.
"How about it, Murph? Are our tags still working?"
"They should be for another 24 to 36 hours. If I can get up to the Congo in time, I have a shot of finding them from a chopper or a plane."
"Has Tiny reached Svakopmund with our citation?" Juan asked, his mind calculating distances, speeds, and time.
"He should be there by about 1.
"Okay, here's what we're going to do.
As soon as we're in range, Murph will chopper to the coast, and Tiny will fly him up to Kinshasa. From there, Mark, it will be up to you to charter any aircraft you need, because Tiny has to fly back for tonight's parachute drop.
I'll need a hand, Murph said.
Take Eric. Max can act as captain and helmsman when we make our rescue attempt.
Eddie Seng spoke up for the first time.
Chairman, there's no reason to believe those arms haven't been spread all over the Congo by now.
Cabrillo nodded.
I know, but we have to try. If the 10 guns we put our tags on are bunched together, it stands to reason all the other weapons are there too.
Do you think Macombo's planning an assault of some kind? Linda asked.
We won't know until Mark and Eric locate them.
Gotcha, Mark exclaimed, looking up from the ThinkPad.
What have you got?
There were some encrypted files on this computer. I just cracked them.
What's on them?
Give me a minute. Juan sipped his coffee while Linda demolished another piece of pastry. Doc Huxley suddenly appeared at the conference room door. She only stood 5'3", but had the commanding presence endemic in the medical profession. Her dark hair was tied in its customary ponytail, and under her lab coat she wore green scrubs that did little to flatter her curvaceous figure.
"How's our patient?" Juan asked as soon as he spotted her.
"She's going to be fine. She was a little dehydrated, but she's over that. The wound required 20 stitches, and she also has 2 cracked ribs. I've got her sedated for now, and she'll be on painkillers for a while."
"Great job."
"Are you kidding? After patching up this group of pirates for a couple of years, I could have tended her in my sleep."
Julia helped herself to coffee.
"Is she going to be okay until you get back, or should you stick with her?"
Hux gave the question a moment's thought.
"As long as she doesn't show any signs of infection, like fever or an elevated white count, she won't need me hovering around. But if the kidnappers have injured Jeffrey Merrick or any of you, well, you know, you're going to want me on our citation for immediate treatment. I'll make my final determination just before I leave, but my gut's telling me she'll be okay."
As always, Juan left all medical decisions to Dr. Huxley.
"That's your call."
"I will be damned," Mark said in awe.
Eric Stone was leaning over his best friend's shoulder, the text from the laptop reflecting in his newly required glasses. All heads turned to the young weapons specialist. He continued to read unaware for a moment until Juan cleared his throat and he looked up.
"Oh, sorry. As you know, what you found out there is a wave-powered generator, but on a scale I can't believe. As far as I knew, this technology was in its infancy, with just a couple machines off the coasts of Portugal and Scotland undergoing sea trials. What it does is use the power of the waves bending its joints to push hydraulic rams. These rams, in turn, force oil through a motor using a smoothing accumulator to even the flow. The motor then turns a generator, and you've got electricity."
As an engineer, Max Hanley was the most impressed.
"Damned ingenious," he said. "How much can these things produce?"
"Each one could power a town of 2,000 people. And there are 40 of them, so we're talking some serious juice."
"What are they for?" Juan asked. "Where's all that electricity going?"
"That's what was encrypted," Mark told him.
"Each generator is anchored to the seafloor with retractable cables, which is why George didn't see them when he did his flyby a couple days ago. When the water's calm or radar on the guard boat spots an approaching vessel, they are lowered about 30 feet. A separate cable feeds the electricity to a series of heaters spaced along the length of the generators."
"Did you say heaters?" Eddie asked.
"Yep. Someone thinks the water around here is a bit cool and decided to heat it up."
Cabrillo took another sip of coffee and helped himself to a Danish before Linda polished off the plate.
"Can you tell how long they've been in operation?"
They came online in early 2004. And what's been the effect?
That data isn't on the computer, Mark replied. I'm no oceanographer or anything, but I can't imagine even this much heat having much of an effect on the entire ocean. I know the waste heat from a nuclear reactor can warm a river a few degrees, but that's pretty localized.
Juan leaned back again, drumming his fingers against his jaw. His eyes swam in and out of focus. The senior staff continued to talk around him, throwing out ideas and conjecture, but he heard none of their chatter. In his mind, he could see the huge generator stations sawing away on the crests of waves, while below them radiant heaters glowed cherry red and warmed the waters flowing northward along the African coast.
If it weren't for the gun-toting goons cropping up left and right, Mark was saying when Juan snapped back to the present, I'd guess this was an art project by... What's that guy? You know, the one who wraps islands in fabric and built those gates in Central Park?
Crisco?
Cristo, Max replied absently.
Mark, you're a genius, Cabrillo said.
What? You think this is some messed up art project?
No.
What you said about a river...
Juan glanced around the table. This isn't about warming the entire ocean. Only one very specific part of it. We're smack in the middle of the Benguela Current, one of the tightest currents in the world. It runs just like a river with clearly demarked boundaries. And right around here, it splits in two. One branch continues northward along the coast, while the other veers west to become part of the South Atlantic subtropical gyre. The gyre carries water along South America where it is heated several degrees higher than the current that's stuck close to Africa.
With you so far, Mark said.
The two currents meet up again near the equator, and as they mix, they act as a buffer zone between northern hemisphere currents and those of the southern.
I don't see the big deal here, Chairman. Sorry.
If the two currents are closer in temperature when they come together, their buffering ability is going to be diminished, possibly enough to overcome the Coriolis effect that drives the prevailing winds, and thus these shallow currents.
Eddie Tseng paused from taking a sip of coffee to say, his face alight in comprehension,
This could alter the very direction of the ocean's currents altogether.
Exactly. The Earth's rotation determines prevailing wind direction, which is why hurricanes in the north rotate counterclockwise, and cyclones in the south move in a clockwise direction. It's also the reason the warm Gulf Stream current that runs along the east coast of the United States moves north and then eastward so that Europe enjoys the weather it does. By rights, most of Europe shouldn't be habitable. Scotland is more northerly than the Canadian Arctic, for God's sake.
So what happens if southern water flows past the equator near Africa? Linda asked.
It's going to enter the breeding grounds of Atlantic hurricanes, Eric Stone, who acted as the Oregon's unofficial meteorologist, replied. The warmer waters mean more evaporation, and more evaporation means stronger storms. A tropical depression needs a surface temperature above 80 degrees to gain enough strength to become a hurricane. Once it has that, it absorbs around 2 billion tons of water a day.
2 billion tons? Linda exclaimed.
And when they hit land, they drop anywhere between 10 and 20 billion tons a day. What causes the variation between a Category 1 storm and a massive Category 5 is the amount of time they spend sucking up water off the African coast. Mark Murphy, usually the smartest person in the room, brightened as he finally understood. With the Benguela being artificially heated and some of that water escaping north, the storms can intensify much faster.
And there can be more of them, Juan concluded. Anyone thinking what I am? that the severe storms the U.S. has experienced in the past couple of years have been given a little help. Hurricane experts all agree that we're entering a natural cycle of increased storm intensity, Eric said, countering Murph's point. That doesn't mean the generators and heaters aren't amplifying the cycle, Mark shot back.
Gentlemen, Juan said soothingly, it is up to better minds than ours to figure out the effects of those things. For now, it's enough they're turned off. After this meeting, I'll call Overholt and lay out what we've found. He'll more than likely turn it over to Numa, and it will be their problem. Murph, have the computer ready so I can send him all the files.
No prob.
For right now, Juan continued, I want us to concentrate on rescuing Jeffrey Merrick. Then we can think about going after whoever installed the generators in the first place.
Do you think there's a connection? Max asked from the opposite end of the long table.
Not at first, but now I'm convinced.
The guy Sloan and I chased with the lifeboat intentionally killed himself rather than risk me getting my hands on him. He wasn't trying to avoid an African jail. He was a fanatic willing to martyr himself so we didn't discover the heaters. And we know Merrick's kidnapping isn't about ransom. It's political. That is, he's pissed off somebody bad enough to snatch him.
Environmentalists, Linda stated flatly.
Has to be, Juan said. We've stumbled into a two-pronged attack of some kind. On the one side, they want Merrick for some reason, and on the other, they're trying to disrupt ocean currents with those big generators.
Eddie cleared his throat.
I don't get it, Chairman. If these people care about the environment, why would they mess with the ocean like this?
We're going to find out tonight when we rescue Merrick and grab us a couple of kidnappers.
Riggers had laid out the insertion team's parachutes in one of the Oregon's empty holds. The shiny black nylon looked like spilled oil on the deck plates. When Juan entered after a 20-minute conversation with Langston Overholt at the CIA, Mike Trono and Jerry Pulaski were already there, carefully folding their parachutes so when they deployed 25,000 feet above the Namib Desert, they wouldn't foul. Mike was a former pararescue jumper from the Air Force, while Ski had come to the corporation after 15 years as a recon marine. Max was chatting with Eddie and Link as they checked equipment and weapons arranged on trestle tables set up along one wall of the hold. Cabrillo knew that every member of the corporation could work with anyone else without the slightest problem, but there were a few dream pairings among the crew. Link and Eddie were one, and Mike and Ski were another. When together, each team was absolutely devastating under fire and could operate at an almost telepathic level. Next to the tables were four rugged-looking motorcycles. These were what the Oregon had gone to Cape Town to pick up. Designed for hard desert riding, they had fat balloon tires for crossing soft sand and extra-powerful shock absorbers. In the past few days, a team of mechanics had stripped them down to bare essentials to save on weight and covered up their once garish colors with a desert camouflage paint job. His ship's cell phone rang as he walked across the cavernous space.
Cabrillo.
Chairman, it's Eric. Just want to let you know that we'll be in range of Svakopmund in 20 minutes. I've already alerted George so he'll have the chopper fueled and ready. Mark's getting our gear together now. Tiny will be at the airport with the citation by the time we reach him, and I've even been able to charter a plane in Kinshasa.
Good work.
If everything goes as planned, we'll be on the hunt at dawn tomorrow.
That'll give you what?
18 hours to search before the batteries die? Give or take. I know it doesn't sound like much, but we'll find them.
Everyone aboard was well aware how personally Juan took being used by Benjamin Isaka and his rebel partner Samuel Makambu.
that he had unleashed so many weapons into a brutal civil war was like a lead weight in his stomach, and every second they were in the field increased the likelihood they would be turned on innocent civilians. Despite what he'd said earlier to Sloane about responsibility, he knew if people died because of this debacle, part of him would die as well.
"Thank you, Eric," he said softly.
"No problem, boss man." "How are we looking?" Juan said as he approached the three men. On the table was a scale model of the Devil's Oasis prison that Kevin Nixon in the magic shop had constructed using satellite images and the few grainy photographs they'd been able to find on the internet.
"Kevin made us a nice toy," Eddie said. "But without knowing the interior layout and Merrick's exact location, we're going in blind."
"So how do you want to make our play?"
As chief of shore operations, it was Seng's job to plan the assault.
"Just like we discussed right from the beginning.
High altitude, high opening jump from about 60 miles north of the facility so they won't hear our plane or get suspicious if they have radar. We glide in, land on the roof, and follow the old axiom that plans get tossed out the window as soon as you make contact."
Juan grinned.
"While Link lowers the bikes to the ground, we will find Merrick and Susan Dunleavy," Eddie continued. "Once we have them, we hightail it out of there on the desert bikes and meet up with Tiny wherever George can find a passable place to land the jump plane.
Don't forget, we need to grab one of the kidnappers so we can have a little chat about those power generators."
"I'll personally truss one of them up like a Christmas goose," Link said.
"You have the schedule all figured out for ferrying everyone to shore on the chopper?"
"Yeah. Because of weight limitations, George is going to get a lot of stick time today. It'll take 4 runs to get everything to the airport. George and I figured it out, so on the last run he'll be carrying the least amount of weight. This way we can strap on the empty drop tanks. He'll fuel up on shore and have more than enough range to scout for Tiny's landing zone."
"Just make sure I'm on the last trip in," Juan said. "I'd like to get some sleep today."
"Already had that in my plan."
"You're now head of the list for Employee of the Month."
"How'd it go with Lang?" Max asked.
"I'll tell you while I pack my chute."
Juan began his careful inspection of the mammoth parachute, one designed to allow a person along with 200 pounds of gear to ride the prevailing winds up to 75 miles as he floated to Earth. A favorite tool of special forces, the rig had extra padding along the straps and employed a 2-tiered deployment system to ease the shock of transiting out of the brief freefall when exiting the plane. Even with these safety devices, pulling the cord was a test of nerves because the jumper knew he was in for a brutal assault to his body.
"Good news on both fronts," Cabrillo said, running his fingers along the riser lines looking for any sign of fraying.
"Lang said he'll contact Numa and they'll probably send a ship to investigate the generators. And because the CIA put the deal together with Isaka, they will pay us to do what we were going to do anyway and get those weapons back."
"How much?"
"Barely enough to cover costs, so don't plan on early retirement."
"Better than nothing."
That Benjamin Isaka turned out to be an agent of Macombo's Congolese Army of Revolution has the CIA's Africa desk in an uproar. Cabrillo started arranging the risers so when he began to fold them, he could bundle them together with rubber bands.
"They never saw it coming?"
"It came totally out of the blue.
It's got them rethinking every asset they have on the continent. Lang says the head of the Africa desk has already offered to resign."
"Will he?"
"She, actually, and no.
Provided we get those weapons back, the CIA is going to wipe this whole fiasco under the rug."
"Why do I have the feeling there isn't a whole lot of room under that rug anymore?"
"Because there isn't," Cabrillo said bitterly.
"No one wants to hear about how the CIA screwed up.
It makes the U.S. look incompetent and, more important, unprepared. So when there is a problem, like how the agency trusted a guy who turns out to work for the rebels trying to overthrow his government. Like that. They go into CYA mode and nobody pays the piper for the mistake. That particular corporate culture is why no one saw 9/11 or Iraq's initial invasion of Kuwait or the sophistication of India and Pakistan's nuclear programs. And, Juan concluded, part of the reason I left. Well, at least we're going to be in position to set things right this time. Juan? The change in tone in Hanley's voice made Cabrillo look up from his work. You going to be okay? Max asked, and nodded at the parachute. Of every human emotion, Cabrillo detested pity most of all. The looks of cheerless sympathy passers-by had given him the day Julia Huxley had wheeled him out of a San Francisco hospital with one pants leg neatly pinned had enraged him. He vowed from that day onward no one would ever look at him like that again. So since losing his leg, he had undergone 3 surgeries and literally thousands of hours of physical therapy so he could run without the slightest trace of a limp. He could ski and swim better than when he'd had both limbs and was able to balance himself on the prosthesis with ease. He had a handicap, but he wasn't handicapped. However, there were still things he couldn't do as well as when he had both legs, and one of those was skydiving. Keeping your body arched and stable while falling through space required minute adjustments of your arms, but mostly it was the legs that kept a diver steady. Juan had made dozens of practice jumps in the past couple of years, and no matter how he tried, he couldn't prevent himself from going into a slow rotation that quickly turned into a dangerous spiral. Unable to feel the sensation of wind pressing against his ankle and foot, he couldn't correct the spin without a jump partner grabbing and steadying him. It was a rare defeat that Juan hated to admit, and Max knew it. It'll be fine, Cabrillo said and continued to fold his chute. You sure? Juan glanced up with a smile. Max, you're acting like an old woman. Once I'm out of the plane, I just need to arch my back. We won't be in free fall long enough for me to start my dervish impersonation. H-A-H-O, old friend. High altitude, high opening. If this was any other kind of jump, I'd be in the op center watching the monitors with you. All right. Max nodded. Just making sure. A half hour later, Juan handed his chute and gear to one of the riggers to carry to the chopper hangar near the Oregon's fantail. Before heading to his cabin for some long overdue sleep, he stopped by the medical bay to check up on Sloan. Doc Huxley wasn't at her desk or in the adjoining operating theater, so he searched the 3 recovery rooms. He found Sloan in the 3rd. The lights were turned down to a muted glow as she slept, propped up on a hospital-style bed. She'd pushed aside her blankets, and Juan could see the dressing covering the wound under her arm. There was no indication the gunshot was still bleeding. Her copper hair was fanned against the white sheets, and a wisp of it fell across her forehead. Her lips were slightly parted, and as Juan brushed the cowlick aside, her mouth pursed as if to receive a kiss, and her eyelids fluttered for a moment before she slid deeper into unconsciousness. He straightened her blankets and strode from the room. 10 minutes later, and despite the distraction of the upcoming rescue and the weight of the missing weapons preying on his mind, Cabrillo was in a sleep as deep as Sloan's. His alarm sounded an hour before he was scheduled to fly to the Svakopmund airport to meet up with Tiny Gunderson. His eyes snapped open, clear and blue and ready to face anything. He rolled out of bed, contemplated another quick shower, and decided against it.
Juan turned on a couple of lights and hopped to his walk-in closet. Ranked like riding boots at the back of the closet were his artificial legs. Some were flesh-toned and hardly recognizable as prosthetics, while others were industrial-looking affairs with titanium struts and visible actuators. He sat on a bench and fitted on what he called his combat leg, version 2.0. The original had been mangled a few months earlier at a shipbreaker's yard in Indonesia. Inside the round calf was a throwing knife and a .380 caliber Kel-Tec automatic pistol, one of the smallest handguns in the world. There was also enough room for a small survival kit and a diamond-dusted garrote wire. Kevin Dixon, who'd modified the leg for Juan, had also placed a flat packet of C4 explosives in the foot and hidden the timer detonator in the ankle. Plus, there were a few other tricks built into the limb. He made sure the leg was snug and, as an added precaution, put on a belt with straps to tie so the prosthesis wouldn't come off no matter what Cabrillo did. He dressed in desert camouflage fatigues and a pair of rugged boots. He retrieved another Glock and an H&K MP5 submachine gun from his gun safe. The armorer would have loaded magazines waiting for him at the helipad. He placed the weapons and a spare combat harness into a cheap nylon bag. Maurice knocked gently on the cabin door and let himself in. As per Cabrillo's earlier instructions, he carried a breakfast tray that was heavy on fruit and carbohydrates. And while he would have loved some of his steward's powerful coffee, Juan settled for several glasses of orange juice. They were going into the desert, and while everything had been well planned, he wanted to be as hydrated as possible, just in case something did go wrong. "You do the Royal Navy proud," Juan said, wiping his lips and tossing the napkin on the tray when he'd finished. "Please, Captain Cabrillo," Maurice said in that reserved voice of his. He was the only member of the corporation to call Juan Captain rather than Chairman. "I oversaw the serving of high tea for 20 officers in a Force 7 storm off the Falkland Islands during that little flare-up. If you would permit me to be frank, sir, you have yet to tax my abilities." "All right, then," Juan said with a fiendish glint. "Next time we hit a hurricane, I would like a Gruyere cheese and lobster souffle with a baked Alaska for dessert." "Very well, Captain," Maurice intoned and retreated from the room. On his way to the hangar, Juan ducked into the infirmary again. Julia Huxley was just closing up a pair of red plastic medical cases. She wore scrubs, but her ubiquitous lab coat was slung over the back of her chair. "I take it by your packing that you're coming with us and our patient is doing well?" he asked by way of greeting. "She woke up about an hour ago," Julia said. "Her vital signs are all stable, and I see no sign of infection, so she'll be fine for as long as I'm away. Besides, my orderlies are better trained than most ER nurses." "All right, then. Give me a minute to say hi, and I'll help you with your cases." Sloane was lying back against a bank of pillows. Her face was pale, and her eyes were somewhat sunken, but when she saw Juan leaning against the door jamb, her mouth split into a radiant smile. "Hello there, sunshine. How are you feeling?" Juan crossed the room and sat on the edge of the bed. "A little groggy from the meds, but okay, I think." "Huck says you're going to be fine." "I was surprised that your doctor is a woman." "There are 11 women on my crew," Juan told her, "including my second officer, Linda Ross." "Have I been hearing a helicopter?" "Yeah, just ferrying some men to shore." She eyed his fatigues and gave him a dubious look. "You said you'd tell me who and what you really are." "And I will," he promised, "as soon as I get back." "Where are you going?" "To do the job we came to Namibia for, and hopefully find who was behind the attacks on you and who built the wave-powered generators." "Are you with the CIA or something?" "No."
but I used to be. And that's all I'm going to tell you until tomorrow. How about I come by at 8 and we can have breakfast together?
It's a date.
Juan bent and grazed her cheek with his lips.
Sleep well, and I'll see you in the morning.
She held on to his hand as he stood.
I want to apologize to you again for getting you mixed up in my problems.
Her voice was solemn.
It turns out your problem is related to my own, so there's no need to apologize. And besides, I should be the one to say he's sorry.
Why?
You didn't find your ship full of diamonds.
Fool's errand, she said wanly.
Hey, even fools win the lottery.
With that, he left her bedside and, with a medical case in one hand and his bag of weapons in the other, headed for the hangar with Julia.